Chapter 3. Why do we fight? There are many answers, but one will always ring true. Look upon the worlds of your Imperium, upon the cities, and above all upon the people. That is why you fight. Codex Astartes. The sun was high, a searing point of light in the black sky. The disk of a ghrelin was half full, the rest of it dipping below one horizon, the sooty wilderness between its hive cities streaked with the spires of Port Memnor's skyline. 12 figures were marched out onto the rock-crete promontory jutting from one of the upper-class hab blocks that clustered a short distance from the Parliament building. This district of Port Memnor was in the grander imperial style, with walls shored up by eagle-headed buttresses, and every street junction watched over by a statue in marble or bronze of sector governors and imperial nobles. It was normally stern and magnificent, but that noon it was more somber than usual, and none could deny the tension in the air. The 12 hooded figures shuffled, heads bowed, at the order of the sergeant of the Memnoran peacemakers. A squad of peacemakers, the armed police force of the city, watched over proceedings as the prisoners lined up. Captain Davinius watched from the adjoining apartment in the hab block. Outside the window, which opened onto the promontory as if onto a balcony, the sergeant took a ledger from one of his troopers and began to read from it. A crowd had gathered. It had been filtered by the peacemaker soldiers stationed in the streets nearby. Most were well-to-do citizens of Port Memnor, wearing more subtle echoes of the ruling class's fashions. The wizened figures of tribal elders stood apart, shadowed by peacemakers and their own attendants, for it was important that they be made a part of proceedings. A substantial number of those watching were from Briseis's media, using pictures and boom vox catchers to record the events.
"We should be seen," said Procurator Colness. "You especially."
He looked very much at home in the apartment, his black greatcoat matching the severe decor of devotional paintings and furnishings in mourning colours.
"I'm still uncomfortable with conducting our business publicly," said Davinius. "The Ultramarines are soldiers, not diplomats." "Believe me, Lord Captain, the sight of you is one of the most useful assets we have," replied the Procurator.
He was a man of the Administrator, one of the few Imperial officials in Port Memnor. His job was technically limited to ensuring the planetoid supplied its portion of Agrellan's tithe to the Imperium, but in effect, he had been in charge of monitoring and fighting the growing xenophile threat before the Space Marines had arrived.
"The massacre at the Parliament has riled them up. They took to the streets in the Chrono Rights district. My people say they're one step from rioting, and Throne knows we don't need that. The xenophiles could commit who knows what atrocities under the cover of such unrest. They must be scolded, these people, shocked into inaction and obedience, and the sight of a space marine in the city will do that. Perhaps you do not know, Lord Captain, the effect such a sight has on an emperor-fearing soul. No doubt the people of Macragge are used to an ultramarine on every street corner. Not so here."
"I concur," said a third member of the party.
The voice was flat and measured, and came from below the hood of a floor-length dark red cloak. Magos Skepteris was the most senior of the civilian imperial personnel on Briseis, but she was not minded to take such a visible place in civil affairs as the Procurator. Her responsibility was oversight of the laser defense batteries and associated plasma generators that defended the city's spaceport, and she had very much the air of someone who would rather be there than here. Only the lower half of her face was visible. Her skin was pale, her chin sharp, and, rather distractingly, her teeth were steel. One of her arms had been amputated at the shoulder and replaced with a trio of mechadendrites that hung, braided and coiled around her neck like a massive gorget of steel snakes.
It behoves us to make all use of the resources at our disposal. Our task here is at least in part a psychological campaign for the suppression of rebellious intentions and the discouraging of xenophile sympathies. To be presented with such a symbol of imperial capacity for violence will crush many intentions of sedition.
We must make use of more than fear, said Davinius. It is devotion to the Emperor and loyalty to their fellow men that will move these people to root out the xenophiles. Not fear.
Not fear alone, granted, said Procurator Colnis. But believe me, fear should come first. The crimes are as follows, the sergeant outside was saying.
This task fell to the local law enforcement of Port Memnor, but no one would be ignorant of the hand of the Imperium behind it.
The placing of the Emperor's goods and persons in the hands of the Xenos enemy. The denouncing of the Emperor and his divine right. The sheltering and protection of Xenos inimical to mankind. The setting of explosives. The dissemination of heretical literature and ideas. Murder of an imperial official. Also, several charges of common murder, theft, and wounding. These charges to comprise a manifest and undoubted instance of heresy, foulest of crimes, striking as it does against mankind itself. The sentence pronounced is death.
Captain, said the procurator, shall we?
Davinius followed the procurator out of the grand windows onto the promontory. The rock-crete expanse had been used as an execution ground by the nobles of Briseis since the first towers of Port Memnor had been raised. The chambers adjoining it had been much prized for the excellent view of the executions, which could be observed by the inhabitants over a glass of strong wine and music. Now many of the noble families had quietly left Port Memnor, leaving only those involved in its government, or who thought they had a way of profiting from the growing unrest, leaving places like this empty. Davinius emerged into the noon sun. The reaction was loud and immediate. The onlookers gasped and cried out. Some were dismayed. Others shouted prayers of thanks that the Emperor's angels of death had come to Briseis. All of them were afraid. Pictors clicked and whirred, trying to get the best shot of the armored giant who had suddenly appeared. Beside him, the procurator and even the outlandish and rarely seen Magos were diminished to mere details. Davinius's armor had the gilded trim that marked him as a captain of the Ultramarines, and he went without his helmet to reveal a blunt, dark-skinned face with a wide and intelligent brow the pictors zoomed in to capture. A picked servitor took flight, buzzing on tiny rotors as it hovered as close as it dared to steal the image of the Ultramarine and transmit it to the city's media.
"I'm sure they would appreciate a few words," said the procurator.
"I'm sure they would," replied Davinius tightly. The sergeant ordered five men to stand forward. They were the execution detail, selected by lot from the peacemaker squad. They were armed with rapid-firing las carbines, their power packs supercharged to deliver greater killing power. It reduced the charge capacity, but only one burst of fire was needed here. The troops stood to face the prisoners, who were lined up against a wall that bore the scars of having been riddled with las fire and resurfaced many times. The sergeant walked along the line of prisoners, asking if they wanted their hoods removed. Some did, most did not. The revealed faces were of clockmakers, dirty and scarred, eyes bleary from years staring at tiny cogs on black velvet. Those eyes widened at the sight of Davinius and were fixed on him rather than the soldiers about to shoot them. They murmured prayers under their breath, as if asking if they were dead and were being confronted by a vision of the Emperor's justice come to usher them into the afterlife. Divinius watched as the sergeant gave the order to ready arms and to take aim. The unhooded prisoners did not take their eyes off Divinius, as a volley of lasfire sheared through them, the sharp cracks of superheated air mingling with the gasps from the crowd. The bodies fell, and those not called upon to perform the execution stepped up to take on clean-up duty.
"Good," said the procurator. "Always a nasty mess when things don't go to plan."
Divinius glowered up at the Pictor servitor, which backed off and panned across the bodies. They lay in spreading pools of blood in undignified heaps. The clean-up detail were unfurling black corpse bags, ready to cart them away in a waiting peacemaker ground vehicle.
"The Xenos wanted the massacre," said Divinius. "They have their hooks deep into this city. We cannot keep killing until the Xenophiles are all gone, or we will not have a city left for the Imperium to make use of."
"Then your battle brothers had better root out the aliens before it comes to that."
"Most citizens," said Divinius, "do not speak to a space marine thus."
"I hope, Captain, to rule this city one day soon," said the procurator. "What remains of the Parliament cannot do it. That Baron Malinar boy cannot do it. He's no more than a child. This world needs a governor. It will be my duty to govern in the God Emperor's name. I can hardly take on such a responsibility if I flinch in fear when confronted by even one so intimidating as yourself. Not that I don't feel some of that fear and awe with which the prayer books instill us."
The crowd were departing, the media crews getting the last shots of the bodies as they were zipped up in their bags. One of the onlookers was escorted onto the execution ground by a peacemaker trooper. It was an elderly woman, her head bent and face lined, thick grey hair tied in long plaits. She wore long dark green robes and walked with a stick, as gnarled as she was.
"One of the elders," said the trooper, "of the Thundercliff."
"Tribals, Lord Procurator,"
said the peacemaker sergeant, who was making a determined effort not to stare at Divinius.
"Tribals?"
repeated the procurator wearily.
"What does she want?"
"It is not with you, Lord Procurator," replied the elder, "nor with the Angel of Death. It is with the Magus."
Magus Skepteris tilted her head in as profound an expression of surprise as she seemed able to summon.
"With me, Elder?" "The deaths at the Parliament have stirred up the people," said the elder. "This you know. These executions and their timing are surely intended to remind the people of their subservience to the Imperium. But this alone will not keep them in check. I can read the pulse of the people as you cannot, my lords. Trust me when I say this."
"And what solution do you suggest, Elder?"
asked Magus Skepteris.
"Only this. The Magus is the most senior of the Imperium's servants, Ambrysius, and, due to her limited interaction with the people, is seen as impartial. A gesture by her would do much to quell the anger of our people."
"I am not accustomed to presenting a public face," said Skepteris.
"There need be minimum effort on your part," said the elder, "and the good name of the priesthood of Mars shall be preserved. A mere ceremony, performed for public consumption, according to the traditions of our world. We request, Magus, that you become a member of the Thundercliff tribe."
"Now, now,"
interrupted Procurator Colness.
"Such a thing would be gravely irregular. The officials of the Adepta have stayed well clear of tribal politics."
"And thus the gesture will have all the more import," said the elder. "Trust me, lords. This is not a step we undertake lightly either. Extending membership of the tribe to one not born to Briseis has never been even suggested before. But we of the Thundercliff love our world, and we despise the unrest in its streets. If we can help quell it without bloodshed,
or the oppression of fear, we shall do so. It is the best way to preserve our way of life and fulfill our duties to the Imperium.
My own duty, interjected Davinius, is to see Brescius secured for the use of the Imperial war effort on Agrellum, with the minimum of violence against its people. Any proposal that will turn the people away from the Xenophiles is one I would support.
The Elder bowed her head in Davinius's direction, showing deference, but none of the fear Davinius was so used to.
My thanks, Lord Captain. Some among the tribes fear you, and say you can only be here to do great bloodshed among us. But the Thundercliff are loyal, and rejoiced when the angels of death were revealed among us.
I shall think on this, Elder, said Major Skepteris.
That is all we ask, said the Elder.
The tribe desires greatly the elimination of the alien influence on our people.
We, the Autochthonos of Briseus, born from the earth, hate the alien with the passion of our Lord Angel here. However you choose to destroy the Xenos and the Xenophile, the Thundercliff shall stand with you.
The peacemakers were hosing the blood off the promontory and moving among the lingerers in the crowd, scattering the onlookers. The Elder was escorted back off the execution ground, her piece said. Davinius noticed how the remaining media crews took pains not to point their pictures at the Elder as she shuffled past a statue of a past governor and out of sight. Down among the tombs, the trail had warmed up. Thaxos had lost it in a great necropolis of black stone, where ancient kings had been buried thousands of years before. Their Saint King cults remained as the thousands of niche tombs for the servants and sacrifices buried alongside them, and the monumental heads that lay split and shattered, which once had glowered across the broken stone lands of Briseis. Thaxos got his last glimpse of the quarry among the fallen features of one pre-imperial king, and by the time he had scrambled up the broken brow ridge, it was gone. Brother Celtus found the trail again. The quarry had been winged by a bolt around, and he spotted the smear of blood on the broken finger of a monumental statue's hand, long severed from its arm. The enemy had leaned here to catch its breath, or patch up its wounds, and had moved on. It was slowed by the action, and the Ultramarines had quickened their own pace, for they were closing in.
Celtus, report in,
voxed Thaxos, as he clambered over a heap of necropolis rubble and found himself looking across a long black chasm, the depths reaching further into the ancient past beneath Port Memnor.
We're out of visual. I'm 50 meters down pursuing, replied Celtus. I can see him. Do not get too far ahead, said Thaxos. He's leading us. There could be more.
There was a ledge, caused by a shifting of the strata of the chasm wall, barely wide enough for a fully armored space marine to navigate. Thaxos's boots crumbled chunks of rock from the edge as he began the journey down, spotting brothers Inigens and Odorak on the other side of the chasm, half sliding down a drift of stone fragments. Thaxos's fire team were advancing from all sides to corner and trap the quarry. The Ultramarines fought side by side, like primitive phalanx soldiers when it was appropriate. But Thaxos's fire team could be cunning hunters as well when the situation warranted it. A river glinted at the bottom of the cavern. The darkness down among the tombs was so profound, even Thaxos's augmented sight could barely make it out as it rushed and foamed.
He's out of sight, came the vox from Celtus. But he's cornered. He's trapped. There's no way up. If there is,
voxed Brother Venarin,
I'll see him.
Venarin was a marksman, as fine a shot as Thaxos himself, and his custom bolter was loaded with long-range stalker shells and a prey-sense scope. Thaxos could just make out Venarin crouched at the lip of the chasm, sighting down his bolter. Bolter fire cracked from below.
Contact,
voxed Celtus. Thaxos scrabbled as fast as he could down the chasm face. The river grew closer, and the rushing of its waters louder. He picked out another sound, the high hiss of pulse fire, familiar from the firefight in the council chamber.
"Multiple contacts," voxed Thaxos. "Venarin, do you see them?"
"Not from here," replied Venarin. "I'm displacing." Thaxos stumbled the last dozen meters. Foaming dark water rushed up to meet him, and he strode into it, the pull of it trying to drag him down and wash him away. Flashes of crimson light up ahead marked the continuing pulse fire, underscored with the low thudding of bolter volleys. Thaxos's own bolter was up in front of his face, every eye movement tracked by the barrel, as he had been sleep-taught since novicehood. Thaxos rounded a corner and saw the enemy. They were barely visible in the dark and clamour. Their faces were completely hidden in the featureless helms of their armoured suits, the desert camouflage incongruous among the tombs. He spotted two or three of them at the side of the river, the red filaments of their rifles' laser sights playing across the rock where Brother Celtus crouched. Thaxos fired almost without having to will it, the order coming from the warrior's part of his brain, cultured and trained by sleep-teaching and veneration of Gilliman's Codex Astartes. A volley of three bolter shells thudded into the torso of one Tau, the explosive bolts blasting off an arm and ripping open the torso. Thaxos counted three more visible, scrambling for cover among the rocks. Celtus leapt to his feet and followed up, two well-placed shots taking down another Tau. These were fire-cast warriors, Thaxos remembered. The Tau society was based around castes, not just social but physiological. The fire caste had quick aggression and athleticism, the water caste cunning, the earth caste physical strength, the air caste reflexes. The fire caste were trained by the Tau Carders as excellent shots and participants in the combined arms manner of Tau warfare. They were not trained to face a space marine in any context, save down the sights of a pulse rifle. Thaxos didn't have to give the order. Celtus was charging even as Thaxos sprinted through the filthy foaming water, rattling off half a bolter magazine to keep the Tau ducking behind the fallen rocks at the base of the chasm. He vaulted over a rock and crashed into the Tau sheltering there, crushing the alien's body beneath all the weight of space marine and armor. He brought his combat knife out and lashed it at the nearest firecast standing. His reach was more than the Tau had expected, and the blade cut through the front of its helm, the monomolecular edge propelled by augmented muscles. The tip cut through the helm into flesh, and the Tau reeled backwards. Thaxos was on the fallen Tau, plunging the blade into the Tau's throat, hauling the alien into the air and blasting three shots into its chest at point-blank range. Brother Celtus cracked his quarry around the side of the face with the stock of his bolter. As the alien reeled, Celtus shot it in the abdomen and put another round through its head as it fell. A firecast leapt out from cover, rifle levelled at Thaxos. The side of its throat exploded, and its head snapped to the side before it could pull the trigger. Thaxos didn't have to look up to know that Brother Venarin had taken it down with a stalker shot.
"Where is the target?"
voxed Thaxos, before the last firecast warrior had plunged into the water.
"They were covering his retreat," said Venarin. "There's a structure up ahead."
"Down here? A tomb?"
"Don't think so."
"Forward!" voxed Thaxos. "Tighten up. Take it prisoner if possible. Shoot if you must."
Past the bodies of the firecast warriors, the chasm took a sharp bend, the water rushing over chunks of fallen stone. The tumult almost hid the entrance to a tunnel in the chasm wall, a solid steel frame surrounding a blast door. It looked as out of place down here as anything could.
"Blow this open," voxed Thaxos. "Odorak, melter bombs."
Odorak had a practical and level head, making him the team's field engineer when no tech marine was present. He carried the squad's melter bombs and a demolition charge and scrabbled down the remaining slope into the water. Vinarin remaining overlooking the chasm as the rest of the fireteam took cover, and Odorak attached the melter bombs to the side of the door with magnetic clamps. The bombs radiated tremendous heat, melting deep, glowing red holes in the door. Molten steel spat and hissed in the water. Odorak stepped forward again and forced the demolition charge into one of the holes, twisting the primer.
10 seconds, he voxed. The alien is perfidious and cunning, said Thaxos. But we shall force him to show his hand. No longer will he hide. And when the light of justice is upon them, there is no escape from the sons of Macragge.
The demolition charge went off. The auto-senses built into the Ultramarine's armor deadened the sound, so they were not deafened by it. The door was blown open. Torn petals of steel splayed wide enough to allow a space marine entry. Thaxos took the lead. The other ultramarines of his fireteam followed him in. Harsh white lights flickered inside, picking out steel floor and white wall panels, and signs in the Tau language pointing deeper into the facility. Ahead was a larger chamber, the walls lined with transparent walled cages. A large brushed steel table stood in the center of the room, a smaller table beside it, covered in fine silver medical implements, designed for three-fingered Tau hands. Thaxos glanced at the cells. They had a single drain in the floor and a single slot in the front wall, and nothing else. Against the back wall were two automated guns, cylindrical units containing pairs of pulse rifles. They were deactivated. Any fugitive here moving too quickly to turn them on to defend the place.
He's desperate, voxed Thaxos. He will err. We will not. Be sharp.
Thaxos waved for Odorak and Keltis to move one way, he, Vinarin, and Inogens the other. Machinery covered the walls up ahead of uncertain purpose, in the featureless casings typical of Tau technology. The antiseptic smoothness of every surface indicated alien minds free of faith, without the guidance of belief in the God Emperor to guide them. The very cleanliness was unclean. Thaxos caught up with their quarry in the facility's interrogation chamber. The purpose of this room was clear, given the man strapped, naked, save for the harness affixing him to the wall, among a tangle of pipes and cables hooked up to his body. Thaxos took in the detail as he scanned the room for targets, and saw one, crouching behind a white cabinet that might have been a cogitator housing or a storage unit for interrogation implements. The hint of movement was enough to draw Thaxos's eye. The alien's limbs were too long to be folded up completely behind the scant cover. It had chosen, in its desperation, a bad place to hide. It had made many mistakes in its life, chief among which was standing against the interests of the Imperium. But its choice of this place to shelter from the Space Marines would be its last.
I know you speak low Gothic, said Thaxos. One chance. Surrender.
Please, came the reply in the dry whisper of the Tau voice. We can coexist. Just listen.
One chance, said Thaxos.
There is something greater than the war between us. Greater than the pride of our species. You are wise among your people. You have not the narrow minds of its citizens. There is a greater good.
Thaxos took two long strides to the alien's position and dragged it out from cover. It was one of the water caste, the diplomatic strain of the Tau species. It was not built for physical conflict, with its spindly limbs and pigeon chest, over which its orange and black robes hung loosely. It had a pistol in its hand, a compact pulse weapon, and Thaxos snapped its wrist with a jerk of its arm so the pistol clattered to the floor. The alien whimpered.
Report,
boxed Thaxos.
Clear,
replied Keltis. Your orders?
Prepare to deny the facility to the enemy, said Thaxos.
Listen,
said the alien, its voice hoarse and broken.
It is not too late for our species. Oito, we can start it. A dialogue for peace, for truth, for...
Thaxos threw the alien to the ground and leveled his bolter at it.
I think this thing counts as a moral threat, said Thaxos. Brothers, do you concur?
I do, Brother Thaxos, replied Venarin.
Thank the throne for that, said Thaxos,
and shot the alien through the chest. The bolter shell detonated inside it, spreading its shattered ribs out through its back. It was dead before its broken form sprawled onto the ground. Huge black eyes turned dull and glassy in the harsh light of the glow strips on the ceiling.
He's alive, said Brother Inogens.
Thaxos turned to see Inogens examining the body restrained against the wall. Now he had time to look closer at the captive. He could see the chest was rising and falling, and readouts in the alien alphabet winked steadily on displays set into the wall panels. The captive's mouth was obstructed by a gag, from which several tubes and pipes ran. Inogens undid a catch on the gag and slid it out, pulling a long, slimy tube from the captive's throat. The captive was a man in middle age, evidently in fit and good health. The fittings around his face came away, and Thaxos saw the well-worn features of a soldier. The man coughed phlegmily, and his eyes opened, squinting in the light. He gasped back, a choking breath in shock, at the sight of three space marines standing in front of him.
You are safe, citizen, said Thaxos. The Xenos are dead.
Dead,
spluttered the captive.
Very dead, indeed,
said Thaxos, indicating the water-cast corpse. The captive chuckled weakly at the sight of the body.
Savages,
he said.
Heathens! We will kill them all.
Inogens removed the restraints one by one, supporting the man's body until he could be lifted down from the wall. He knelt on the floor, coughing, chest heaving.
Your name?
Asked Thaxos, removing his helmet. When dealing with civilians, the more human face was the better one to show. He took out a data slate and cycled through various intelligence files on its screen.
Dwynan Vula Kasioth, replied the captive. Explicator errant. In service to Inquisitor Vengel Priens, Damocles Task Force Conclave.
Thaxos flicked through pages of names. Dwynan Vula Kisioth was among the inquisitorial agents known to be operating in the system, deployed in their dozens by the Inquisition to embed themselves in imperial settlements and watch for signs of xenophile treachery.
Are you a call sign?
He asked.
Dawnlight,
replied Kisioth.
Then I hope you are enjoying the sights of Briseis, Explicator Kisioth, said Thaxos. How did they capture you?
The xenophiles had men in the peacemakers,
said Kisioth.
I bedded down in the precinct house. Woke up down here. Must have drugged me.
Did you talk?
Kisioth looked up at Thaxos. His eyes were rimmed with red.
I don't know,
he said.
Melter bombs set around the entrance,
voxed Odorak.
They'll bring the ceiling down.
We'll get you to the surface,
said Thaxos, helping Kisioth to his feet.
I must ask for a weapon, said Kisioth. They have a lot of Xenos down here. That much I know.
Your sidearm, brother,
said Thaxos, and Inogens handed his bolt pistol to Kisioth. The weapon was made for a space marine, and Kisioth had to hold it with both hands.
Stay alert, said Thaxos. We've killed all that stood before us, but there may be more. The alien could have got a distress call out. Normally, I would relish the chance to kill a few more of them, but we have a guest to think of now. Move out.
The ultramarines left the facility, emerging into the darkness of the chasm. Venarin scouted ahead, Keltis watching their rear.
Wait,
said Kisioth, as they began to forge through the rushing water.
There's a defense system. Drones.
They're stationed across this region. If they were alerted, they'll come in from overhead.
Eyes up, brothers, said Thaxos, glancing towards the distant stone ceiling of the tombs. He could see nothing in the grey-black expanse.
Kessioth held out the bolt pistol in front of him, barely able to lift it.
For the greater good, he said,
and shot Brother Thaxos through the back of the head.